a diamond, some days a stone, sometimes a heart. Some days a diamond, some days a stone.
Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me one more time. And I can't thank you enough, especially those that are subscribers to this virtual foray into some sort of altered states of reality, looking to make sense out of the senseless, up the down staircase, in the outdoor, and always look for the obvious buried in the absurd. That's what I've been doing since I started radio in 1970. No, that's when I was in high school, which I'll get to in just a little bit. My first show was August 27th, 1997. It seems like a very, very long time ago. Thousands and thousands and thousands of radio shows have come and gone in between that time. And if you'd asked me back then that, you know, one day you'll be doing what's called a podcast, I'd have been like, give me a hit on that. And by the way, let me just have full disclosure. This is one of the great things about doing a podcast. In my right hand is a cold beer. Yeah, that's right. This is something I could never do on live radio or even taped radio in a studio at WGN, or certainly not Harpo. And maybe at CBS I could get away with it. But here I am in my own studio. I've worked my nads off the last 4 or 5 days on a lot of different projects. And I thought to myself, hey, self, why don't you have a cold beer? And so when it turns fall time, which is football time, really, I switch beers. You know, I don't know if you're a person like that. I like beer. I grew up on Old Milwaukee, which was like my dad would buy a case of 24 for $6, you know, not high end. And he'd keep it at the bottom of the stairs. You fetch the beers, this and that. When I was probably 14, 15, he started that whole, if you're going to drink, son, you're going to sit with me and drink first. And so I learned how to drink beer on Old Milwaukee. You know, you'd actually need a can opener or a bottle opener to get into it. And then a little bit later came the hard stuff. He said the exact same thing. Look, if you're going to be stupid and go to the bar and drink, first you're going to drink with me. My dad was a lot of things, but one of the things I think I remember most about him was that forthright way of kind of old school. If you're going to do it, we do it first. Then you know what it's all about. We never got to the cigar thing because I've never smoked anything in my life, contrary to what you might think, but never went that route. But it went from Old Milwaukee, and then when the hard stuff came along, he put down 101 proof Wild Turkey and said, son, here you go. If you're going to drink everything less than this, you can survive. And by the way, you keep this in your trunk, and if you ever need gas at some point, just put in the carburetor. You'll be all good to go. I'm like, great. So I was probably 16, 17 at that point. And sitting down on a Friday night, my dad would open her a decanter of Wild Turkey. He had these very fancy decanters. I mean, they were worth, you know, big bucks back in the day. It was an actual Wild Turkey-looking decanter made out of porcelain or something, filled with Wild Turkey, 101 proof. He wasn't kidding about having a kick. So I grew up on Old Milwaukee beer and 101 proof Wild Turkey, and you wonder why I act the way that I do? Anyway, when I drink a lot of the local stuff during the summer, just as a refreshment, Budweiser old style. When I was in the Coast Guard back in 1980, I don't know how this happened, but I one day bought a six-pack of Moosehead beer. And I don't even know where I got it or where I was stationed at that point, but that was it. And I bought it in September. It was the fall. I was living off base. I was living the high life, kids. I'm here to tell you. I had an 80-foot trailer, and I had to put some bug bombs in every, you know, 6 months to kill all the stuff that was living there. I slept with a 22 pistol under my pillows because there were rats underneath it, but I was living large and in charge, and I literally I drank so much Moosehead beer that I built a fence out of the bottles. I had a porch. It wasn't big. It was probably 6 feet by 6 feet with a handle or a rail around it. It was maybe 4 or 5 feet up high. I can't remember. And I started stacking the bottles, and I learned real quick that the flies would go in there looking for the smelled sweet. So they'd go in there and they'd drown, which was like bug control. But I literally built a wall of glass bottles made out of Moosehead beer bottles. So it was really great. Anyway, I have a Moosehead. What I should do is send this podcast to Moosehead, say, let's do Moosecast. And once a month, I'll drink beer like this. Ready? Here we go. Pretty good stuff. Anyway, I'm all about full disclosure these days. You know, once you hit 60, you kind of, who gives a shit, right? What are you going to do? I'm not FCC regulated at all. I could actually start doing shots of Wild Turkey. You want to talk about entertainment? It could get really interesting. It's been really busy the last week or so, and I'm a little remiss in getting a podcast out. I just spent a lot of hours on a book project, and I felt I needed a beer. So let me just start with a little recap, because these were some of the elements that I was going to put in last Wednesday. Then it got even more busy. Then I was going to put in Thursday for Throwback Thursday. That didn't happen. And then, of course, Freebie Friday. That didn't happen. Saturday, I was on the air live here in Chicago. We'll talk about that as well. So here we are on a Montag in my native German language. Tomorrow would be Dienstag. Montag, Dienstag, I think that's right. Mittwoch is Wednesday. And I can't remember the rest of the week. Freitag's Friday, go figure. So a week ago today, I was very, very geeked up because the following day, which would have been last Tuesday, I was very, very honored and still am. I still can't even believe I was there for the unveiling of the Walter Payton statue at Soldier Field. I've been a longtime friend of the Payton family, and I've watched Jarrett and Brittany grow up from just little kids into great sports broadcasters, and Brittany does the news, and they got families, and I keep looking and thinking they're like 14 and they're like 35 or 40, but that's how it works. And Connie has just been a great friend all these years, especially the last 20 years since Walter passed away. And so back in August, early August, she sent me a text and said, hey, are you busy September 3rd? I said, depends. And she sent me this invite. I was very touched and loved to go. And it was the unveiling of the Walter Payton Sweetness statue and also George Halas statue at the main entrance at Soldier Field. And I wish I would have grabbed some audio. I probably could have used it, but it was just like kind of overwhelming. You know, I mean, you know a guy, as I knew Walter after he retired and worked with him for a few years and stayed friends and all that kind of stuff. And then when he passed away, that was like, wow, there's a kryptonite because Superman's gone. And that was surreal. And this was even more surreal. 20 years later, this November would be the day that November 1st is when he passed away. This statue's put up. Nobody knew what to say. And I'm not sure even to this day, a week later plus, that I could adequately describe how I felt besides breathless. And without words, because it was just this, you know a guy, he was larger than life when he was alive, Walter Payton. So was George Halas. Now they're 12 feet by 3,000 pounds, which is just intimidating as hell. And I eventually made my way up and looked at the statue. And the thing that struck me the most was Walter's hands. And so it was just really, really interesting to me how that all played itself out. Matter of fact, I always say I rarely script anything on this show because I got beer. Well, who cares about a script? But I did write this the day or two after, and I thought if you didn't see this on Facebook, I would share it with you now. So in lieu of Throwback Thursday on the podcast, this is what I spent my time on. It's 4:30 in the morning, and I'm supposed to be using this time, that slice of the in between the dark and the light, to lock down final edits on a book project. Coffee's on, crickets are singing, there is a slight cool breeze crawling across my desk, but sentence structure and spell check are not on my mind. Walter Payton is, however. As the Chicago Bears kick off their 100th NFL season tonight on the lakefront, of course we know they lost to the Packers, thousands of fans will make their way to the main gate, throngs of them, many of whom will have been tailgating for hours prior to the game. They will flood the entrance to this historic stadium and greeted by two 12-foot-high, 3,000-pound sentries cast in bronze. On the left is Papa Bear George Halas, the man who put the NFL in place and led the Bears to becoming the monsters of the Midway. And on the right is Sweetness, with his signature towel tucked in his waistband, arms stretched out, reaching for another yard or would-be tackler. At the unveiling on Tuesday, a couple hundred of us gathered as the tarps were removed on these two icons, and while there was a smattering of applause, a hushed silence quickly washed over us. Both of these men, larger than life when they were alive, portrayed so vividly and permanently and personally total reverence. I was amazed at how sculptor Chad Fisher had captured so many details, but especially Walter's hands. I was fixated on him. Remember the times his vice-like grip would lock on my shoulder or back of my neck at a meeting, or just because he felt like it. Whether he used those hands to hammer opponents into submission while holding the football like it had a handle on it, or for handing out toys to children that were dying of some hideous disease, those hands required great strength. Last night, Teresa and I attended a watch party. That's what they call it now. You know, when people go to a bar and watch TV? Now they call it a watch party. For the premiere of Savoring Sweetness, The Life and Times of Walter Payton, produced and hosted by Walter's son, Jarrett. I wasn't prepared to cry, but hearing Walter's voice again for nearly an hour straight, seeing him in his element and with his family made the waterworks inevitable. In the middle of it all, JP, the kid who I watched induct his father in the Hall of Fame when he was just 12 years old, and who I first met when I helped put together the deal with the WWF to have Walter team up with Razor Ramon and christen the brand new United Center back in 1994. The young man who was finding his way in the world after making a run into the world of pro football and then moving that aside to continue the work of the Walter and Connie Payton Foundation. When I became the senior producer for the Dr. Oz Show on Oprah Radio, it was the perfect opportunity to have Connie, JP, and Brittany have a serious national platform to talk about the work of the foundation and the importance of becoming an organ donor. Not long after that, I visited JP at Columbia College, where he had just started his broadcasting career with a little talk show out of a tiny studio with not many people listening. Something I can relate to. Since that time, his determination, spirit, and energy, and most of all, heart, have kept the doors open for him. JP currently handles the sports on WGN-TV in the 5 p.m. news slot. Last night during the broadcast, Jarrett came over, sat next to me for a time, and while the big six screens on the wall behind the bar had images of Mongo and Danimal talking about sweetness, I couldn't help but keep an eye on JP, watching the special he'd produced and hosted about his father. I'd seen that focused look before. Months of work, hundreds of hours, was a true labor of love. When the program ended, Jarrett did exactly what Walter Payton would have done. He got up on a chair, held the room in the palm of his hands, and thanked us all for being there for the event, but more importantly, for the Payton family over the last 20 years. Wasn't a dry eye in the house, as he led us in a chorus of tears. One of the great joys in life is to bear witness and watch someone grow into the fullness of themselves, knowing that they understand to whom much is given, much is expected. I had a lot of moments this past week around all this activity, but the most profound wasn't watching the unveiling or hearing Coach Ditka or Virginia McCaskey at the podium or even have lunch with Otis Wilson and Steve McMichael. It was when Jarrett snuck up behind me at the Soldier Field reception and he locked his arms under mine and around my chest in a big bear hug and he squeezed really hard. And for a second or two, I thought it was Walter because that's one of his moves. It was in that moment I realized that in so many ways it was him. And that sweetness is alive and well and in very good hands. So if you didn't catch that on Facebook, it was something I just wanted to fit in today because it's my show and I'm drinking beer and I can do anything I want. But now it's time to move on to some other stuff. We took care of all that. It was a phenomenal week for the Payton family. And I am still just kind of like the hair of my arms are still standing up, knowing that those statues are there and I got a chance to participate in that. But Friday last week was another big deal for me. So we go from Payton to Prio. Frank Prio was my football coach in high school when I was on the varsity team. And I was very, very honored to be co-captain. In 19, Jerry Ford was president. And my partner, Tim Anderson, is now a teacher there. He teaches in the music department. And Coach Prio, no problem saying this, was really our Lombardi. You know, he had an incredible staff, but he was the figurehead, and he had an incredible journey to get to become head coach at Sears. He was there for decades coaching, and we were the benefactors of discipline. I don't know that people say that much anymore, the benefactors of discipline. The discipline it took from I first came out as a freshman in Frostsaw football to go to practice every day, to go to school, do whatever, and then take a pounding on the field. And then come back for more. And my dad was a fantastic guy, but I needed a Coach Prio in my life. And hundreds of young men felt the same. So last Friday, there was a rededication of this field that's right next door to Schurz High School. It's literally across the street. And if you're ever on the northwest side of the city at Addison and Milwaukee, Schurz is this monolithic brick fortress that's a block long and a mile wide. And, you know, it's just this huge structure. At one time, based on attendance, it was the second largest high school in the city. That's when I was there, and it's dropped off precipitously, which is not a word I use very often. But anyway, there it is. And when I was at school there, and before me, and many years after me, this field was like playing at the longest yard or something. We used to call it Astroglass or Dog Shit Stadium because there was so much junk out there and garbage on this hard as rock, sparse grass, mixture of clay, stone, cinder, glass, you name it. It was all mixed in there. And it was barren, basically. And there was no fence around it. There was a kind of a banged up goalpost on one end. And it was only about 80, 85 yards long. You can't really play a full game there. So we would go out at practice and all line up at one end of the field, right under the goalpost. And we'd walk. This is in spring practice. And then when we came back in the summer, and all we do is pick up garbage or broken glass or cinders or kick dog shit around. God knows what else was in there. And this was the way that we practiced as long as I was there. And as I mentioned, many teams after that. And it was, you know, if there's a place to get like you need a tetanus shot, that'd be the place. It's called a tetanus stadium. But it toughened us up. And I have great memories of that field. About 5 years ago, a effort was made to start upgrading it after decades of, you know, looking like a prison yard, basically. And that all took place. And so Friday, they had finished everything a while back, and they were rededicating the field to our coach. And this place is a spa now. It's like they called Empire Carpeting to put down. It's incredible. It's a soccer field. It's multi-purpose, but it's a soccer field. They can play soccer games there. There's a baseball diamond, and it's a carpet. And the football team will still practice there. They won't have any skinned knees or glass stuck in their legs like we did. They're certainly not dog face, you know, feces smeared on their face in a tackle. All the good stuff's gone. It's just very antiseptic now. But it was such a thrill to go there because I know the man it's named after. And when I asked him a while back, and I got to be careful because he's a subscriber of this podcast. He's like, Augie, you probably shouldn't have said all that. Well, so what? It's my show, coach. We were the benefactors of that discipline, and because I know the man, no greater tribute could be made to have his name on that field. But when I asked him how he felt about it, he, of course, deferred right back to the team thing, which was, well, I really see it as a testament to the coaches and the players that made that all possible. And that's these days when it's all about me, me, me. He was always about we. That didn't sound right, but you get my drift. And that's how you win. And that's how you lose, too, together. So when I went out there Friday, I got to run into the old guard. Now, listen, they let probably the whatever period it was, maybe seventh, eighth period out to be witness to all this, which means the kids got out of school. They have no idea who I am. They have no idea who Coach Prio is. They wonder why all these old people are out there. And they're just waiting for the bell to ring. Plus, there was free hot dogs, which I cashed in on in a big way. And I got pressed into service because Coach Prio's daughter kind of just gave me the paper that was written, said, hey, would you please read this? And I said, sure. And Mr. Anderson, who was my co-captain in 1977's, conducting the band, and this is as surreal as it gets. And I'm thinking, when was the last time he and I were on this field together at the same place in the same time? 1976. And then I looked through the crowd, and there are all the greats, the Acerettes, and the Ridgeways, and the Larsons, and the Pontes, and the Riveras, and the coaches, Coach Pearson, Coach Reed, and Coach Klaus, and it was just a who's who. There was a guy, Rich Hill was there from 1966, came out for this. So there's something about a sense of dedication and discipline that we were benefactors of that has carried us through our life, and that's really what this is about for me when I do these shows. Can't quite pinpoint it, even though I was very fortunate to know Walter Payton and very fortunate to be in his orbit and to learn things and still very fortunate to be part of the, you know, the orbit of the Payton effort and be included in that. My time spent there on that field and the 4 years I was at Schurz has been instrumental in whatever success I've had. Instrumental. Every time I run into somebody, which I did, I actually was there 2 hours early at the school, and this guy comes up to me who I haven't seen since 1976, and he was a wrestler there, and we started talking, and he's like, I heard you write books. I'm like, yeah. He goes, you can write? And I said, well, I can. You can read? You know, we're busting on each other a little bit. But there was no indication back then that I would do the things that I do now. However, the discipline, the dedication, the not staying down when you get knocked down thing, all that stuff matters. I learned all that from football. And I have this one memory in particular. I have thousands of them. But the one that kind of conjures itself up right now was when I was going out for varsity football. I already played frosh soft, and I was sophomore going to my junior year. And listen, I can tip the scales pretty good these days. Hang on, it's time for another Moosehead. Hold on. That's good stuff. Did I say that already? Good. And my dad dropped me up. He was taking me to practice. It was a rainy day. He worked not far from where school was, but he's driving me to practice. It was tryouts. And all summer, my sophomore year, all summer, all I did was run into trees in the yard. I had full equipment on that I think I got from Sears or something, and I would run into these trees just, you know, knocking myself silly probably. And my mom would just shake her head, you know, okay, let him go. And it's better than, you know, doing other things apparently. And my dad took me there, and he parks the car, and there's all these guys walking to go into, there's a tunnel that you kind of go in, you can go into the main gym from off the street. It was raining, it was warm. It was late summer. You know, it's a lot of tactile stuff going on. We pull up there, and I'm wearing white shorts and my white Schurz T-shirt, you know. And I said, Dad, I'm ready. Dad, I'm going to make varsity. And I was a sophomore going into my junior year, and it was going to happen. I was at the time about 5, maybe 6 foot tall, about 175 pounds. But I thought I was Deacon Jones or Dick Butkus. And that wasn't the case. But in my mind, I was. And I remember getting ready to get out of the car, and I said, Dad, I'm ready. And I've been hitting trees all summer. I'm ready. I'm tough. I'm ready to go. And my dad looked at me in his very matter-of-fact, button-down manner as the banker that he was, and he said, Son, trees don't hit back. He was right. That sophomore year of mine, hoping to get on varsity, I had to deal with the likes of a guy named John Sifnotis and Mike Rogers and Al Craig and Mike Puffpaff and all these guys that were basically our gods and monsters at the same time, you know, and it was just it was a thrill. So diving in a little deep here, but the point is that you never know where these influences are going to come from and how they're going to play out later, matter of fact. And those two guys, Prio and Peyton, had such profound impacts on me in very, very different ways and for different reasons at very different times, but I could see some connections there. And you could take the discipline and the dedication that I learned at Schurz on the football field, and Walter Payton exemplified that on the football field. So these are tried and true things. And so whenever I come across someone, and I've had, listen, I don't get LinkedIn. I mean, I'm on it. I don't understand it because I got all these people that want to link with me, and then they all want to do is just sell me something. Like, I don't need that to do that. Anyway, I get these pitches all the time for people who want to be guests on this podcast. I'm very choosy about who I give this platform to because it's my show. And they better like Moosehead beer. Matter of fact, time for another swig. That's good stuff. And there are a lot of life coaches that want to get on and talk about how to be life coachy. Not interested. They're all under the age of, you know, 30. They've all want to write best-selling books and tell people how to live their lives, and I'm not having any of that. There is a time and a place for lessons in life. All of mine have not come because I went to a seminar and paid somebody to tell me how I should live. My life lessons have come from my grandmother, my dad, my mom, my sister, my kids, and my coaches in the matter of course of life. And I think that we're in this school of life, and that's where you learn these things. Now, that I'm not going to say that there isn't value in places that you can, you know, look, I read Emerson and all that. I mean, you can, listen, if you really want to change your life, you don't need to spend $1,000 and go walk over fire coals. You can buy a copy of Think and Grow Rich for $1.99 and get Emerson's essays for about $2. Just read that. You'll be good to go. Again, not saying there isn't value in these other things. I've done a lot of speaking, but I make it very clear that there's no secrets and no shortcuts. When I ran wind sprints on that shitty rag-ass field and I had to build up my endurance, I didn't understand why it was happening in the moment. But when I was in a game and it was the fourth quarter and I wasn't tired, I understood it. That's not stuff you learn because you took an online course. So in all of that, that was quite a week. And then I topped it off with going on live radio just a couple days ago on Saturday in Chicago. Full disclaimer, I'm starting to like the podcast better. I can say whatever I want, whenever I want, about whatever I want. And that is not always the case on live radio. Now, look, I've always said that my whole gist is to take a look at human behavior and see how to improve on that, improve the human condition. And there are places that the human behavior we have, for better or for worse, is on display 24/7. Politics is number one, religion is number two, sports is number three, in my opinion, observation and experience. So, but I don't want to sit and talk about political policy because you know what? I can't do anything about that. Sorry, I'm not in any committee. I don't sit in Congress. I can't do it. So for me to have a verbal dodge and parry, to tug and war, dodge and parry, I think there were attorneys I used to know. Maybe not. Anyway, to have a verbal tug of war with people over policy to me is just like blowing your nose without a Kleenex. So what's the point? I don't get it. And so the station I was asked to sit on is a progressive talk station here in Chicago. I know, thrilled to do it, happy to do it, incited to do it, but I have to be careful how I talk. I can say shit on the podcast 10 times in a row. No one can do anything about it except go, oh my God, he said shit 10 times in a row. Can't say shit 10 times in a row on regular radio, traditional radio, terrestrial radio. So I had to come up with an alternative word, and the word I came up with was shirt. Shit, shirt, whatever. And so there was a rash of bull shirt, and that shirt really bothers me in place of, you know, shitsky. And it was kind of on the fly. And there was a young kid that was my producer for the day, and he just grinning from ear to ear. He's, I've never heard anybody do that. I'm like, stick around, kid. You'll hear some more shirt. So when I did this show, I needed to be able to cover some of the political stuff without being political. And I could do some sports stuff, so I had Connie Payton on. We talked about a lot of what I just shared with you. And then I kicked into human behavior as it pertains to the current occupant of the oval orifice and all of that, and how these are lessons to me. You know, these are opportunities. These are choices. These are liabilities disguised as possibilities, you know. And try to come with it some sort of educational, inspirational way that isn't just about people calling up saying you're stupid. I had a line of callers on hold that wanted to talk to me about how stupid people were. I mean, I could do that myself. I don't need you to do that. The second hour, I had a gentleman on, and we discussed, which I found fascinating. What something is worth is always up to what people will pay for it. I have a football helmet sitting under glass, you know, 5-6 feet away from me, and it's signed by Jack Youngblood, the Hall of Fame defensive end for the Rams. I think I paid like a couple hundred bucks for it. And when he dies, that'll be worth like $800. I didn't buy it hoping Jack Youngblood would kick off, but my point is that it's all arbitrary. What something is worth, what the value is, you know, subjective. It's not objective. And in the headlines here in Chicago was breaking news, or I call it broken news because it really isn't breaking anymore, that Sean Spicer, the former White House spokesman, and Donna Brazile, who is a political pundit, I think she's on CNN now, but she certainly was on NPR for a while, two very different people, are being paid $50,000, $25,000 each. It's somewhere in there. One of them might be getting 30, one's 25, I don't know. But Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago are paying $50,000 to have them speak at some point before the year is over. And there was a loud uproar about all this. And I found it fascinating because, again, full disclosure, I've done two TED Talks. I've been speaking for 25 years. There's been times I've made more money talking for an hour. My dad made it a month. And there are times where somebody's like, here, you want a piece of chicken? I'll trade you. Okay. So it's like the gamut for me. I don't set the prices unless I do. Most of these people are booked through speakers bureaus who get a chunk. So let's say Spicer or Brazile getting $25,000, they'll probably come away with, you know, 19, 20, which still is pretty good payday. And The uproar was, is how could a struggling state school afford to pay these people this kind of money, and why would they do it? Well, they're struggling because, or they were, because the budget wasn't passed. So you got to take these facts. I don't like headlines like that. It's just poking at people. Something else to piss them off. And so it's not, they're not struggling like they were. There's a budget's been passed. There's a new governor in Illinois. Things are really quiet. And then the speaker series is funded by a private donor who wants to bring in diverse voices to create dialogue. So I don't know who picks the speakers. They didn't ask me, even though Bill Curtis and I have been here twice in the last 3 years. I don't know who picks them. I don't know who sets the price. I'm sure it's the Speakers Bureau. And I had this journalist on, and we were going back and forth about this. And he's like, well, you know, there's a lot better things you can do with 50 grand. Well, no question about that, but I don't think that's the point. It's a private donor. But it really comes down to value for me. Is what Sean Spicer has to say worth $25,000? To me, it isn't. Nor is it probably worth it for Donna Brazile to talk for an hour for $25,000. These are kind of inflated, bloated, celebrity-type paydays. Now listen, wait a minute. Time for another swig before I really get serious. Say it with me. That's good stuff. If somebody came up to me at a university and said, look, you know, you're a TED Talk guy, you've written these books, we love what you do, we're going to pay you 20 grand. I'm like, where am I going? I don't have a problem with it. Not because I think I bring any more value than they do one way or the other, but it's all about what the market will bear, what kind of value you think people will walk away with, all those type of things. And so we're having this debate, and he had salient points. Yes, there are other ways to spend 50 grand, but it's not like the school's spending it. Some rich alumni's funding it. So I didn't know what the point was. But to me, it was a bigger question. And it comes back to, matter of fact, this podcast. To some degree, I'm going to use this as an example because I'm on a roll. I started this a year and a half ago when my goal was to have 50 people subscribe. And I'm like, well, how much am I going to charge? What's the value of 23 years on the radio? I've written 3 books. I've done 2 TED Talks. I've done thousands of radio shows. I've conversations with everybody from presidents to athletes to you know what. And to me, a vast well of information and stuff I can share. What's that worth? $5? $10? And I was actually ordering from the local pizza place here, Rocky's, over in Westchester. I ordered a large, I think it was an extra large, actually, thin crust, half light mushroom sausage pizza, which is fantastic. And it was $20, $19.95. And I thought to myself, I just spent nearly $20 to eat a pizza. Literally, I could fold it in half and eat it if I really tried with some Moosehead beer. And I thought, I can't believe that a podcast would, you know, 4 to 6 of these shows a month isn't worth $20. I spend that going through a drive-thru. However, that's me. I'm on this side of the mic. So I thought 50 subscribers is good. They'd be a good base. It'll build itself out. I don't know a whole lot about that marketing stuff in the digital age. I know a lot about the terrestrial radio stuff, but I'm willing to do this, and I'm willing to pick it up and see where it goes. So out of the 50 people who initially said, yep, we're all on board, you got to play the odds. So out of 50, 40 actually followed through, and out of the 40, 35 actually really followed through. So the 15 that didn't, I'm like, okay, so, you know, I kind of figured that in. And in some way, shape, or form, it's kind of stayed at 35 subscribers. People who on an ongoing basis find value in spending $20, which is $5 a week, for this, for me to drink beer on a podcast and kind of bloviate, speculate, and sometimes verbally defecate. That is worth it to them, and I'm thrilled for that. What I'm really interested in is that there are like 180 people who follow this show and listen. Whatever I put up, they listen for nothing. So they're really listening because the subscribers make sure that it stays on. And that's the PBS model, which means 80% of the people who watch public broadcasting never put a dime in to support it. They watch because 20% does. And I'm okay with that model, but I just find that fascinating. I'm thinking if you find value in this, cross the line, plunk down pizza money, and let's keep going. Because at some point, even though I enjoy this and I look forward to doing it, at some point it's like, okay, kind of just beat my gums together here. And it's, you know, it's enough money to buy pizza during the month, but maybe there's another level. Maybe there's not. Point being is where people find value is really up to them. So if you, here's my pitch. I haven't done this in a while. If you find value in this and you're one of these people that are following it and you're listening to the shows like I did last time with Paul Langlois, parts one and two, or Jerry Kramer, or Christian Piccolini, or Dr. Jane Goodall. I mean, you know, consider it. And the easy way to do it, just go to any one of the episodes that are on the page that says subscribe to premium content and click it, and you get pay $20 a month. And then you and I get to drink beer together, so I think it's a pretty good deal. Speaking of beer, it's time for another one. Almost gone. Pretty good stuff. I spent 5 hours today on finishing up a project that has been ongoing for almost 2 years. And in late 2017, I was approached to help a woman named Trudy Groning, who grew up in Munich, Germany, who lived through the Hitler era there, finish a book that she started in 1967. So in 2017, she approached me through some mutual connections, and at the time, she was 89 years old, and I'd like to finish this book. And I said, sure, you know, send over what you have, email to me, and I'll take a look at it. She goes, well, I don't use email. She doesn't sound like that either. Very German lilt in her voice. And so she mailed to me, snail mail they call it, which is just regular mail. I've never seen a snail actually deliver the mail. So off with that. And it was 44 pages. Some of it was kind of repeated, and it was a fictional account of her life growing up in Germany. And I did not want to take it on. Not because I didn't think I could write it, but because I didn't think I could write it. I don't know how I would do justice. I wasn't alive then. So I flew out to Lancaster where she lives. I recorded a conversation for 4 hours. We talked about a lot of things. Came back. I stewed with it for a little bit. And I decided to move forward. But I had to make some changes and create a narrative and a storyline. So I did that. And it took a year and 2 months to finish the book, pretty much working on it every other day. And the book came out in 2019. And has, you know, marketing is a huge part of this. And so my backstory on all this kind of stuff, the things that have been keeping me busy, is that I've become this mini publisher for people who would never get published. So she's one of them. I've done 5 books in 6 years this way for people who have a story to tell. They have a way to reach people. And I help them do that because the publishing business is bullshit and they would never get published. So that's what I do. I help along with 9 other things that I do. And so it was thrilling to see her name in print, her pictures on the cover. She was ecstatic. And at one point she said, maybe we can do the book in German. Sure, no problem. I don't speak German that well. I didn't think she'd ever actually do it. Probably last November, she called me one day and said, I think it's time to do it in German. Okie dokie. So I found a German translator. We got the thing translated. It took 6 months. And just today, the author's proof was finally is being sent to me to sign off on. And the reason I bring this up most specifically in this podcast is a couple of things. It goes back a little bit to football. This woman is now going to be 91 in December. The dedication, the discipline, the perseverance, 50 years after she started writing with a pen and paper when she was, you know, half her age, is astounding to me. How do I not honor that? And now to keep going, I can pick up, I actually talked to her twice today, and she had some corrections, she had this, she had that, and I'm thinking, she's clearer than I am. So in 2 weeks, myself and Professor Peter Blanc are going to fly out to Lancaster, PA. He's the gentleman that translated the book, and they're having a book launch for her, and the German Club is sponsoring it. Now I got to make sure all the books are where they're supposed to be in time. And I sit and pinch myself going, how does this happen? And I don't mean just for me. I think the underlying theme here is the more you say yes to things in life, the more things in life say yes to you. Opportunities open up, things that you never thought you could do, you can. And so a surprise to some of my teammates are that I've written books and do TED Talks and all the rest of that stuff. Some ways I'm not. I've said yes to a lot of things. Doesn't mean they're easy. But being on the radio, sit and be able to produce shows, all this stuff that's it's in one hand perfect. In the other hand, I still go, wait, what? I get to do what? I'm not anointed in any special way, but I do know that the basics I learned on that rag-ass field, discipline, dedication, pushing a blocking sled with a 200-pound Ray Smith on there barking at me and saying things my dad and mom never even said or even thought, that goes a long way when I feel like not working today. I could hear Ray in my head, Augie, God damn it, let's get going. Me and another guy be pushing that sled in the heat. And when you can do that, sitting at a computer is not such a big deal. And one of the things I brought up when I was on the live radio the other day, just to digress a little bit, was this environmental thing that is coming up as we go into the presidential election. And Elizabeth Warren, who at this point for me, as an independent person, seems to have the cajones that it takes to kind of get some things done. To some degree, they're all full of crap and bullshitting and whatever. But I like what she has to say. I like how she says it, more importantly. She came out with a 200-point plan for the environment. Well, that's great, but Congress is going to, you know, decide what happens and what doesn't. And in lieu of that, in lieu of any environmental plan, I thought the best thing to do is just include right now an episode of Earth Matters with Bill Curtis.
Once upon a time, the name Nestle meant the very best chocolate. Now it means hot water. Today, there are more than 700 brands of bottled water sold in the United States. It's the ultimate marketing campaign. People buying that which they can get for free from their own tap. Competition is fierce, so it's no surprise that cutting corners becomes accepted business practice. Nestle Waters North America has long drawn water from wells that tap into the Strawberry River near San Bernardino. It's come to the surface that they have been transporting water on federal land without a permit since it expired in 1988. With the drought conditions in California, an impact assessment has been launched to determine what the effect millions of gallons of water taken out of the wells has been, and what action, if any, should be taken against Nestle. As California dries up, bottled water retailers clean up when it comes to sales. I'm Bill Curtis for Earth Matters.
I was talking with a friend of mine earlier today, and I realized that, and I said this on the air, and I say it quite often, the only person that really likes change is a wet baby. We don't like change, and secondly, we want somebody else to make the change for us. And so when I was on the radio and I was watching all these callers, you know, weighing in on certain things, I thought most of talk radio is filled with people who know everything about everything but really haven't done much of anything. And I take a measure of pride in that I've done a lot. I don't just talk about it, I actually do it. I do the talks, I write books, I put these Earth Matters together, everything that I can possibly do to use up the time that I've been given. And if all you're going to do is complain about how things are and not actually engage in them, then I think you're full of bullshit. And I brought up this quote, this comment that was dropped in my ear by Nate Boyer, the highly decorated Green Beret veteran brother of mine who served two tours in Iraq and is just an incredible human being. And now he spends time putting NFL players and veterans together to have PTSD to help them work their issues out. He asked me one day in a show 5 years ago, 4 years ago now, what do you do every day to earn your Americanism? He wasn't kidding. We have a propensity in this great land of ours to sit back and complain and hope somebody else we vote into office takes care of business. And I've always tell people, if there's an issue that bothers you, do something about it. You'll be so busy doing something about the issue that you won't sit around and complain about it. And especially when it comes to the veterans thing. If I see one more headline or one more Facebook post about how the veterans are coming up with the short end of the stick, here's an idea for you. Go to the VA and volunteer your time. You'll feel good about yourself, and they'll be glad to have you. And then you won't have to worry about the veterans are getting the shaft because you're actually doing something. To me, that is the essence of what this particular episode is about, Peyton and Prio, and all the rest of it. You just don't stand on the sidelines yelling. You actually get in the game and play. Whether you win or lose is kind of third on the list. You got to engage in the activity. Very, very important. So when it comes to environmental things, I put these Earth Matters in for a very specific reason, because hopefully they might trip your trigger a little bit and say, you know what? I can go do something. There are things you can't do anything about. I get it. You're not going to stop climate change and global warming overnight. It's not going to happen. I get it. Got it. But you can do something. Where you're at right now with what you have. And that, to me, is how you earn your spot on this plot of ground, on this part of the planet. Thanks for listening. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.